pay the man who works me. I hate that she has to parade around in front of all those muddy oglers, but it's better to be on the stage than behind it.
But why not escape? Take your chances. 3 years.
Senlin stifled his horror, realizing that he was just rubbing salt in the wound.
How can you wait?
Adam gave him a soft smile of defeat that seemed years beyond his age.
I felt the same way, he said.
He had been edging forward on his seat for many minutes, but now he settled back into the crackling leather.
And then I lost my eye.
The words hung heavily in the air. Sympathy and the desire to fix this tangled mess, to somehow advise a retroactive solution, had already exhausted Senlin. He wished that he could put off the remainder of Adam's miserable confession. But as is often the case with men, once the silence has been broken, it can't be recovered until everything has been said. Adam, sensing Senlin's discomfort, tried to lighten his narration.
Not long after I ruined your day, I robbed a bunch of tourists fresh off a train in Babel Central Station. I wasn't supposed to. It wasn't part of the job. Goal gives a shopping list, a schedule, a budget, a timetable, and a postcard so you never forget to write. But I saw them standing there, just like I'd stood months before, happy and confident and dumb as they come. I thought, here it is. Here's your chance to shorten your sentence and save your sister. I told them I was a porter from the train company, come to take their luggage to the ferry. And they couldn't wait. They were so excited. They gave me everything they owned. I had to hire a wagon to carry it all.
Boreas scratched the edge of his brown leather eye patch and gave an unconvincing laugh. Senlin could sense the guilt that loitered beneath the surface, but Adam rushed on.
I sold it all as quick as I could, dresses and bassinets and hats and shaving kits and jewellery. I walked away with nearly 20 minas. If Finn Gollard found out, he would have sent Irene over to pound it out of me. So I decided to sneak my way back to New Babel, come in through Ginside Port on the other end of town, bribe Rodion with everything I had, and be gone with Valita before Gol could cock an eyebrow.
What happened?
Pirates, Adam said with a dry scoff. Me and 5 other worthless souls bought passage on a ship that looked legitimate. Really, it looked like a classic courier ship, a tall bark with 3 envelopes and 2 boilers, built for load and durability, but a pretty ship. But I should have paid more attention to the crew. Instead, I was hanging over the gunwale like a kid, picturing Valita's face when I told her we were leaving. Then the bark got up in the high air, and the captain wanted to renegotiate the terms of our voyage. His proposal was this. We would give him everything that we had, and he would not push us off a plank. One man argued. They threw him over. The rest of us emptied our pockets. Afterward, we were dumped at the most convenient port, which happened to be the parlour. I didn't think I could argue, though I knew I was stepping into deep mud. I'd been careful for 2 years to avoid that awful place. I wanted to forget, but... Adam pointed at the circular brand on his arm. They remembered me, and they made sure I would remember them.
Adam flipped up the egg-shaped patch of soft leather, showing a purple drooping gash in the centre of an empty eye socket. The scar seemed sacrilegious on the young, handsome face, but Senlin did not grimace or look away.
Tom... Don't tell me I can't wait. I can only wait. We have to be patient. We have to work our way free.
Adam flinched with the final words, reset the eye patch, and looked down at his empty hands. Senlin wanted to argue. He wanted to rouse the young man from his despair and inspire him with some grand plan. He tightened his jaw to keep back the flood of advice. This wasn't the time for motivational speeches or proposals. Adam had emptied his heart, and his confession needed no critique. Adam sat like an understuffed doll, and Senlin knew the only thing to do was to break the pall of misery that had fallen over the room. He stood and began shoving his arms into the sleeves of his black overcoat.
"I have never seen the inside of a pipe organ," he said, and took up the aero rod, holding it now as if it were a cane. "You know what the old organist at my college used to call his instrument? The Plumbing That Sings. He joked that every time he pulled out a stop, somewhere on campus, a toilet flushed. With this, and a half-dozen other silly anecdotes, Senlin endeavoured to revive Adam's spirits. Adam hardly resisted as they departed the station house, requisitioned a steam carriage, and began the trip into New Babel. Whatever was to come, Senlin was not about to let his friend face it alone. Adam steered the shambling auto-wagon through the streets of New Babel. Steam clung to the road and curb like a pie crust. Seated on the high driver's box alongside him, Senlin watched as traffic careened in and out of the gloom, mad as jacks. Ashy white buildings rose about them like grim teeth. Bats swooped through the fog, which glowed a molten gold in the electric light of street lamps. The air was heavy with a damp chill. He hated the Stygian city and had avoided it for months. Had it been left up to him, Senlin would never have found the notorious steam pipe. From the outside, it looked like every other building on this and every other block. It looked like an undecorated crypt. But Adam was well versed in the subtle variations of the New Babel grid, and had no trouble finding it. He parked the auto wagon on the street and led Senlin to a metal service door at the end of a narrow alley. They were met and led in by an older cleaning woman, who Adam obviously knew. The two of them chatted amiably about her sore foot, and the inconsiderate young women she had to clean up after, and other banalities Senlin could not contribute to. He was distracted by the room anyway. The broad ceiling stepped closer to the rough plank floor the farther they went in. Senlin supposed that they were under the risers of some great room, probably the tiered seats of a theatre. Crammed inside the shrinking room were the brass intestines of a leviathan. Pipes snaked out from a central tank, running to every corner of the room. Black needles danced across the white faces of gauges. The room was pleasantly warm, a rarity in the boudoir. Senlin took the opportunity to open his coat and loosen his collar. "Wet steam comes up into that boiler and is superheated," Adam said, materializing at Senlin's side. Senlin glanced about and realized the cleaning woman was gone. "Most of the pipes go to heat the theatre and the bedrooms upstairs. But these," Adam said, and pointed at a trio of thick pipes, "power the turbine, which inflates the bellows of the organ." Adam continued his technical explanation, and Senlin could sense the young man's passion for the intricacies of the machine, even as the details flew over his head. He tried to force himself to follow Adam's explanation, but he was distracted by their stooped passage behind the boiler and its medusa of pipes that sweated and hissed about them, through a tunnel that thrummed with the drone of an engine, and up a narrow, unlit stair. They stood before a model city of spires. Some of the towers were made of wood, others of copper or tin and lead. They stretched up between a black-painted wall full of scaffolding and rigging, and an immense red curtain. Such a strange, unexpected spectacle. The towers of this model city, he quickly realized, were in fact the pipes of a mighty organ. There were hundreds of them. Adam explained that they had passed under the main stage of the steam pipe and were now backstage. "There are pipes on stage that look like diapasons, but they're just dummies. They blow air, but don't produce sound. They're just for show," Adam said, concluding some lengthy mechanical note that Senlin had missed the start of. "If they're dummies, why do they blow air?" Senlin asked gamely. But before Adam could answer, they were interrupted by a man entering from the backstage wings of the theatre. Over a tuxedo, he wore a cape that was silver-lined and crimson-backed. Senlin couldn't decide whether it made him look theatrical or insane. The man was in his prime, at least. He wore his dark hair oiled and in a queue, and the skin of his face was tightened to the bone, unlined when relaxed, and, Senlin suspected, heavily rouged. This could only be Rodion, the whoremonger.
"There's something wrong with the Ottava diapason, Adam. It has no oomph, a crack in the pipe, or perhaps the rats have been at the seals again," Rodion said lightly enough, as he swept to a stop before them. He eyed Senlin like a dominant rooster. The metallic threads in his cape glittered ridiculously, even in the dim backstage light.
Perhaps if he had met Rodion at a dance social last spring, Senlin would have been intimidated by the man's ostentation. But as it was, the whoremonger reminded him of a watered-down commissioner, a weak man in strong costume. Senlin was afraid the commissioner might pursue him to the ends of the earth, but Senlin doubted Rodion was capable of such persistence. He looked like a dramatist, a man with more props than power. Far from being impressed, Senlin wanted nothing more than to put his thumb in the man's eye. Rodion continued.
"Valita goes on in 20 minutes. If the organ isn't fixed, I'll have to find some other work for her this evening."
The implication was clear enough. Senlin could feel Adam's tension, which came on as reflexively as a salute. Adam seemed to calculate how long the repairs would take, frowned at the worrisome conclusion, and curtly excused himself to work on the problem. Rodion turned back to Senlin.
"Port Master Thomas Senlin, finally we meet," Rodion said, without a hint of warmth to his voice.
"I came to assist Mr. Boreas," Senlin said.
"Liar! It doesn't take two men to stuff a rag in a mouse hole. You came to see some knickers."
Rodion leaned into the portmaster.
"All right. I came to see, the show," Senlin said.
"Of course you did. I'll find you a seat," he said, with a sizing glance.
He seemed to be gauging Senlin's level of interest in his sordid business. Obviously, the whoremonger was accustomed to capitalizing upon other men's lust, so he was testing the portmaster, tempting him in the hopes that Senlin would expose some exploitable weakness. Senlin saw a clear advantage in allowing Rodion to believe that he held something over him. Let the man think what he wanted. The whoremonger's mislaid confidence would make him vulnerable to flattery and manipulation later. All Senlin had to do to coddle the man's ego was sit through a burlesque performance that starred Adam's sister. Senlin suppressed a shudder, quickly replacing his grimace with a smirk that reflected Rodion's own knowing smile.
"You really must see what all the fuss is about," Rodion said.
Chapter 8 Today's candidate, the Fat Alistair. She's a merchant ship, 46 feet, stem to stern, with 2 20-pound guns and bunks for 12. A good candidate on the surface of it. Unfortunately, she flies the colours of Pelphia. Stealing from the Pels, who I must one day infiltrate, seems beyond stupid. The search continues. Every man's tower, one man's travails. By T. Senlin. Senlin sat rigidly in the plush theatre seat he had been ushered to, his error rod laid across his knees. He was sure the boiler room was beneath him. He could feel the slight pulsation of machinery through the floor. The contrast between that gloomy underworld and the golden theatre that soared about him was almost surreal. Senlin was surrounded by hundreds of men decked in what passed for formal attire in a city of labourers. Moth-chewed coats, threadbare hats, and collars the colour of cigar smoke were in evidence everywhere. The men were agitated and eager. Ornate theatre boxes, arrayed with plaster friezes of reclining nudes, hid wealthy spectators from the prying eyes of the rabble below. Mid-stage, Rodion sat at an organ keyboard that was shaped like a crescent moon. He played with stiff-armed vigour. The organ sounded like an aviary. Each note was loud enough to prickle the skin. Rodion pulled at the banks of ivory stops as expertly as a cherry-picker, changing and layering the tones to suit the passage he played. The man's talent was undeniable. Behind the organist's console, a bank of pipes rose in tiers from the floor halfway up the proscenium archway, filling the stage. The lush red curtain, which Senlin had recently seen the back of, fluttered from the wind that burst from those dummy pipes. Most of the gleaming copper resonators seemed large enough to swallow a man. Above him, the high domed ceiling had been painted the colour of a clear sky. But it wasn't the vast and polished pipes, or the flamboyant organist, or the thunderous chords that enthralled the men who filled the theatre. It was the women who came on stage and climbed the face of the brass mountain with flirtatious immodesty.
They climbed up and pranced along the tops of the pipes, agile as mountain goats, graceful as ballerinas. They were uniformly young and made up, their eyes exaggerated with charcoal and paint, their mouths lurid as smashed cherries. All were ribbed with tightened corsets, frilly skirts flowered at their hips. Blasts of air erupted from the pipes beneath the climbing and bounding dancers, blowing their skirts above their waists. The dancers covered their mouths in a parody of modesty. The audience leaned and rocked and applauded in their seats. The black stockings, the white garters, the flashes of bare thigh. It was as if the erupting music was peeling them bare. The thought that Maria might somewhere have been reduced to the same fate was enough to make him want to shoot out the lights and strangle the organist and plunge the whole horrible scene into silence. But he was in the obvious minority. The rest of the audience didn't see sisters and daughters, lost souls and adventuresome hearts. They saw beams of limelight swinging across banks of kicking legs. They saw greased teeth and jouncing bosoms. When their locks were blown straight above their heads, the women appeared to be hanging by their hair like fruit from a tree. Senlin wondered which one was Velita. Rodion concluded his song with a volcanic flourish and turned on his bench to face the crowd. The ladies grabbed their skirts and curtsied above him. The applause slowly died as he held up a white-gloved hand for calm.
"Good evening, gentlemen, and welcome to the steampipe."
He paused for the wave of sincere cheers.
"Please see the doorman if you're interested in a more private performance. My staff is as clean as my pipes."
Laughter pealed.
"Not all women are created equal," he continued,
and Senlin recognized the words as scripted.
"Some are beautiful, some are daring, some have a talent, athletic or exotic."
An obscene call from the crowd elicited a new bout of laughter.
"But I have only ever known one woman capable of flight. And so, without further ado, the girl you all paid to see, Velita, the Flying Girl!"
A hatch opened at the apex of the blue dome, and a woman seated on a trapeze was lowered through. The voluminous black hair that hung in wild kinks about her shoulders made her head appear large and her body slight. She wore a purple leotard that covered her muscular bust and broad hips, and bared her lithe, olive-skinned legs. Even from a distance, Senlin could have identified her as Adam's sister. She had the same broad mouth and the sharp nose, but her eyes were all her own, large, violet, and painted round with green. Blue sequins glinted at her temples. She smiled, not seductively, but like an artisan taking delight in her work. She pumped the trapeze until she swept up the incline of the audience, then back up the cliff face of the pipes. Such fluidity and nonchalance. Rodion played a haunting, theatrical tune that seemed full of danger. Senlin was mesmerized. In one deft motion, Velita flipped over the bar, and for a moment he was sure the trapeze would leave her behind. But she twisted in the air like a wisp of smoke and caught the bar again. Dangling by her arms, her slippers brushed the outstretched fingers of the more brazen men who reached after her from their seats. Then, at the limit of her swing, she released the bar and corkscrewed like a maple seed, catching the bar as it began its return. When she somersaulted, her unruly, beautiful hair accentuated her body like the tail of a kite. Senlin's heart rose into his throat, enlarged by fear and awe. She was spectacular. After a few further acrobatic feats, she slowed the swing of the trapeze, waved with childish abandon at the crowd, and was hoisted back through the hatch in the dome. This time, Senlin found himself contributing to the manic applause. There was a brief but touching reunion backstage among the rigging, fire buckets, and the sparkling dandruff of a thousand costumes. Adam's usual haggard expression fell away as he swung Velita about in a glad embrace.
Senlin felt privileged to be present for the happy moment. The grounded Valita seemed somehow smaller than the flying girl. She was unreserved, almost silly in her expressions, and seemed in many ways the opposite of her brother. Adam introduced Valita to Senlin, and she shook his hand with the soft, shy grip of a child. But she was not a child, and there was a quick intelligence behind her gaze. Even so, she had her tics. She often guffawed after anyone spoke with any seriousness, as if she found earnestness itself funny. The guffaw was short, not at all feminine, and sounded more like a baritone's ho-ho than an 18-year-old girl's laugh. It was an oddly endearing quirk. Valita talked rapidly about her routine and her frustration with being kept always inside, and her jealousy that Adam got to see the sun any time he wanted. She concluded this single-streaming sentence with an effusive description of a box of 4 bonbons she had been given as a gift, 3 of which were heavenly, and the 4th disgusting. Adam said little, but his smile was eloquent enough. Senlin suspected these occasions were rare for them, and he wondered whether lost loved ones were perhaps sometimes preferable to imprisoned ones. Then, all too soon, Rodion appeared, followed closely by a retinue of young women, ushers, makeup artists, and a slew of other stagehands. He preceded them like a king, still wearing his foil and crimson cape, but now with a new addition. The silver butt of a pistol protruded from a holster at his hip. Rodion insinuated himself into their happy little trio, driving the smile instantly from Adam's face. He pointed at Valita.
"The next show is in half an hour. You need to eat and get back to wardrobe. Go on," the whoremonger said in a tone that parodied parental concern.
Valita gave him a sour smirk, though one that was free of any real rebellion, and turned to peck her brother on the cheek.
"Don't eat the bonbons, Valita. They aren't gifts. They're installments from men who are trying to buy you," Adam said.
Valita let out one of her honest ha-has.
"If somebody wants to buy me with chocolate, they're not going to like what they get," she said, ballooning her cheeks and hooping her arms around an imaginary large belly.
This time Adam didn't laugh. He looked pale and bereft. Valita turned her violet eyes on Senlin.
"You're his boss. Order him to be happy, and then hit him with a stick until he is. Just follow him around with a broom handle and give him a whap when he sighs," she said, clapping her hands.
Before Senlin could answer, she rose to the points of her toes and kissed him on the cheek, just as she had with her brother. Valita was absorbed again into the procession of dancers and stagehands, the group fizzing away into the bowels of the theatre, where changing rooms turned into bedrooms, and some spectators paid handsomely to become leading men for a while. As the group was turning the corner, one straggling, yellow-haired dancer glared back at them. No, not them, but at Senlin. Her glare had a sinister edge to it, and he realized he'd seen her before. Yes, he'd seen her on the barge on which he'd escaped the baths. Hadn't she glowered at him then, too? Before Senlin could pursue the bothersome thread of thought, Rodion grabbed the reins and whipped the conversation toward his own destination.
"Such priceless genius," he said, nodding after the receding chatter of the group.
His chest puffed with undeserved paternal pride.
"Priceless! I would never dream of letting that sort of talent languish in obscurity. The whole world deserves to see her act."
Senlin could tell that Adam knew the whoremonger was baiting him. The young man did not rise to the bait. Senlin was proud of him, though the victory was short-lived.
"An Algesian baron caught her act the other night and was impressed. He wanted her private performance, but per our agreement I told him that such exceptional beauty and skill was not for rent."
Rodion's tight, anemic skin piled about his mouth like an old man's knuckle. It was a ghastly smile.
"I'm a whoremonger. I prefer dealing in whores. There's no courting, little turnover, no complex negotiations or proof of maidenhead, or questions of pedigree with whores. The life of a wife-monger is exhausting, but your sister does all the work for me.
She goes on stage and she courts them and haggles with them and proves herself 100 times more convincingly than any doctor or genealogist ever could. She's making this old whoremonger into a peddler of wives. I said she was priceless, but she has been searching for her price. The Algesian baron suggested that it might be 25 minas. But what are your thoughts? What do you think your sister is worth?
Adam strained forward, his ears red, the veins in his neck stood out roundly. Senlin knew what was coming. He had on many occasions in his time as headmaster seen the victims of bullies abruptly arrive at their breaking point. The fight that followed was invariably bloody. Rodion was pushing Adam to the edge of self-restraint. He was looking for an excuse to shoot the troublesome brother of his star performer. Senlin had to intervene. Senlin swung the heavy error rod low, striking Adam at the back of his knees. The young man, caught off guard, dropped like a stone. Sprawled on the backstage floor, Adam rolled awkwardly at Senlin's feet, staring up at him with an expression of shocked betrayal. Senlin hiked his head toward the backstage door and said, in a flat, pitiless tone,
"Boreas, start the wagon."
Adam rose and collected himself, never once taking his eyes off of Senlin, his initial surprise quickly hardening into anger as he headed with a slight limp for the door. Senlin could only hope the youth would forgive him. Rodion was squinting at the portmaster as if he had sprouted horns.
"Well, the bookworm has a spine after all," he murmured, and then, squaring his shoulders, he asked, "Why did you come here? Why, really?"
"Finn asked me to poke around."
The lie came out casually, as if Senlin was too bored by the deception to continue it.
"He wonders if he's getting his full take of ticket sales, so he asked me to count heads. He can sit on his thumb for all I care, him and that elephantine woman," Senlin said.
It was all bravado, of course, but Senlin's many years of observing playground sports had taught him that a little chest-thumping was often the best way to discourage a bully.
"Tell me your head count, and I'll report it."
136, Rodion said. "I don't believe in generosity or fraternity, so tell me why you're sparing me this trouble."
"The man's paranoid enough without confirming his suspicions. If he finds one leak in his purse, he'll look for more, and I don't want that."
He rapped his error rod once on the floor in punctuation, drawing a boom from the hollow stage. Senlin turned to leave, and then, pretending to be inspired by a pestering thought, pivoted back to face the whoremonger.
"And I would think the girl is worth 30 minas at least. Such a spectacular creature."
It was a weak goad, but Senlin hoped it would be enough to stir the whoremonger's greed and buy them a little time to plan. If there had been any question in his mind before, there was none now. He would do all he could to help Velita escape this black-hearted cad. Adam wasn't fuming. He was deflated, which was infinitely worse. Senlin had hoped the youth would just repay the blow with one of his own. Instead, the young man sat slouched over the spindly wheel of the auto wagon, his eye half-focused, unconsciously kneading the back of his leg. Senlin apologized for hitting him, and Adam's only response was to stop massaging the sore spot.
"He would have shot you!"
Senlin had to nearly shout to be heard over the knocking of the pistons. Adam mulled the point over, first nodding, then shaking, and finally rolling his head miserably. He seemed on the verge of breaking down. He said with choked pride,
"He hasn't broken her. You saw her. She is indomitable."
The lightning in the barred cupola over the city sparked with sudden ecstasy, pausing their conversation. The thorny light pierced the fog and immolated scores of moths and bats. When the bottled storm ended, Adam continued with renewed force.
"I am responsible for making sure she stays unbroken. I am responsible. I must do something!"
Senlin wanted so badly to say something, to blow upon the spark of Adam's revelation, but he worried that doing so would only undermine Adam's confidence in it. So instead of lecturing, Senlin decided to confess his own failure.
I tried patience in the baths. I had a method and a schedule I kept for weeks. I expected a fair result, expected the tower to reward my self-discipline with a miraculous reunion.
He made a throaty sound of disgust.
If I had kept my timetables and nursed my entitlement any longer, I'd be a hod now. I have no doubt. And Maria would be lost to me forever.
So, what did you do? Adam asked.
I robbed the commissioner. No, first I conspired, then I infiltrated, then I flattered, then I conned, and then I robbed the commissioner.
A little satisfied smile lightened his face.
Oh, if Fingal knew how much of a mess I left behind, I'm sure there's a bounty on my head in the baths, and probably worth a little fortune to the commissioner.
I took something of his, and I'm sure he'd like it back.
He heard the bragging tone that had crept into his voice and coughed to cover his chagrin. He needed to circle the conversation back to its purpose.
My point is, we must sometimes take calculated risks, Adam. We cannot expect the tower to treat us fairly, or expect the powerful to respect us.
Calculated risks? Adam scowled and wrung the wheel until his knuckles were bloodless and white. Do you have a plan?
A plan still forming, but I know the pieces that we'll need.
That's a place to start, I suppose. What will we need?
Senlin counted the points out on his fingers.
A ship, a crew, and a wind.
Adam straightened in his seat as the enormity of the list sunk in.
I was really hoping you'd say that we needed a bit of rope and a sausage, he said,
scratching at the patchy shadow of her three-day beard.
A ship, a crew, and a wind, That's going to take a lot of calculating.
And what about a captain?
We'll need one of those, too.
Senlin laughed.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Chapter 9 Tucked among the old ledgers on my office shelves are a dozen flawed dictionaries, several primers on aeronautics, which I have thoroughly perused, and the best of which I've claimed as my own, and at least 30 unique and useless guides to the tower. When I read them, I want to shout, "Draw me a map! Show me the way!" But all the authors do is describe their footprints and talk about their shoes, which are always the best, the only true shoes. Every Man's Tower, One Man's Travails, by T. Senlin. Swift action was undermined by duty, which suddenly overwhelmed Senlin and Adam and every aspect of the port. Barges and ferries filed into the docks in such quick succession that Senlin felt like he was drowning in crates of rum and haggling captains and pie-eyed women bound for the boudoirs. The port workers, plunged into shifts that lasted 20 hours or more, might have rioted if they'd had any energy left. Senlin had to abandon his accounting to assist at the weigh station. The scales had to be loaded and unloaded as rapidly as a catapult besieging a city. It was near madness, and yet Senlin's system somehow held. No ships were turned away, no valuables were absconded with, and no perishables perished. The auto wagons overheated but did not explode, and after 3 days of furious activity, the port was calm again. Senlin cancelled the evening assembly, and instead of standing on it like a soapbox, he sat on the lip of the weigh station, arms on his knees, watching the men move toward the tunnel to New Babel. A few stopped to ask him to read an address on a broadside, which he did, automatically. A stevedore named Emrit asked Senlin to decipher a note from his sweetheart. Emrit was missing a prominent tooth, but when he smiled, the gap didn't seem like a flaw. It reminded Senlin of a dimple in a cheek. It was an attractive quirk. The note, written in the uncertain, tight cursive of a novice, asked Emrit for a meeting, asked him to bring chocolate, and made a rather clumsy reference to an intimate act, which Senlin recited with a physician's professionalism. Emrit thanked him for these revelations, and joined the vein of men moving out. Despite their exhaustion, they were all in the happy throes of anticipation. Some would go to the boudoirs, some to the crumb houses, some to the pubs, and they would all slink home to the yard at some miserable hour, all the joy wrung from them, all the anger exhausted, and all the anxiety spent. Senlin was a little surprised to find that he wanted to go with them. He could do with a little distraction, a little oblivion. But no, there was work to do. Later that evening, Adam tromped up to Senlin's apartment, carrying a small wooden cube, a late delivery from the port. Adam found the portmaster seated at his uneven table, with an open book and an open bottle. Senlin glanced up at the hardy little crate, recognized it, and hiked his chin toward an empty corner of the room. Adam set the shipment of white crom down, and backed away from it quickly. Neither of them liked having to handle the stuff. Senlin had nervous visions of the crate being dropped and cracking open. He imagined the powder erupting into a fog, an overdose in a single breath, a cloud full of nightmares.
"The men are drunk," Adam said, in a voice flattened by exhaustion.
He settled into the rough wood chair across from Senlin, and though he was tired, he still tested the chair before giving it his whole weight.
"They've earned it," Senlin said, hardly looking up from the prone book as he scooted the bottle nearer his friend. "As have you."
Adam accepted the offer and enjoyed a long, contemplative drink. Outside the windows of Senlin's apartment, the revelry of the men reached a new, exalted pitch before settling again into a low slur of laughter and song.
"I gave them a raise," Senlin said, in a way that suggested Adam shouldn't be surprised, though the young man was. "In the nearly 3 years I've been here, there has never been a pay raise. How did you talk Gol into it?"
"I didn't," Senlin said, not glancing up from his book and the complex schematics of a steam engine that lay there, obscure as ancient hieroglyphs.
"The port is so efficient now that the increase won't affect the 8 o'clock report."
"Are you serious?" Senlin looked up. "Trust me, he won't notice. And if he does, I'll just explain that it was an overdue act of self-preservation. I staved off a revolt. You can't work a crew half to death and expect them to come lapping back for more punishment."
"Maybe so," Adam said, with an edge of doubt. "But why now? If he does find out, he'll have you, Wren, put your head on a spit. Why risk it?"
"Well, because I've been thinking, and I've come to the conclusion that our prospects are pretty grim." Adam started to laugh, tried to catch himself, and then gave in to it.
"Oh, but your list is so short. A ship, a crew, and a wind. Easy peasy."
Senlin closed the book, but his expression did not open any further. He had the concentrated, pained look of a man playing a card game he could not afford to lose. For a moment, there was no movement in the room except for the shuddering shadow of a moth beating itself to death on the sallow electric light overhead.
"Here are the problems as I see them. First, we need a ship. A tug or a barge won't do. If the ship isn't reasonably agile and minimally armed, we won't get a mile from port before we're boarded or shot down. But if the ship is large, we'll need an equally large crew to fly it. That's something we can't afford. Never mind that for the moment.
Let's say we find a modest ship that can be operated and defended by a crew of 5 or 6. A ship that had a cargo hold large enough for a few weeks' rations of food, powder, fuel and water. A ship that is neither so ostentatious that it attracts unwanted attention, nor so pitiful that we're turned away from the nobler ports. The perfect balance would be like the dress code for the steampipe. Shabby formal. Even if such a ship exists, how would we take it? We haven't the numbers to overwhelm a crew. So," Senlin paused, with a finger raised to hold his place as he took a gulp from the bottle. He gasped a little and continued. "We will need to use someone else's strength and numbers to do our work for us. But they, whoever they are, will of course have no interest in throwing themselves into our battle to risk their lives for our reward. Which leaves us with a difficult question of how to empty the ship, presuming, of course, that we can gather a small, faithful crew to fly her once she's off the moorings. Added to this impossibility is your sister Velita, and it is the same problem. Rodion is sealed up in his very own fortress, and he has, by my count, at least 30 men. They play usher and stagehand, but they are without a doubt his armed guard. We don't have the strength to muscle our way into the steam-pipe and extract her. We must use someone else's arm to beat in the door. So we need 2 proxy armies, one to clear the ship, and one to save your sister. And presently we have no armies.
And no crew, Adam said.
And no ship, Senlin added, helpfully. The moth that had been battering the light raised a fatal clank and fell to the floor. Adam shook his head and said, But what does all this have to do with giving the men a raise?
I'm currying favour. We may need them to stand with us.
In that case, however much it was, the raise wasn't large enough.
You're probably right, Senlin said, deflating a little. At the very least, they might hesitate to wring our necks, should it come to that.
It sounds like your plan is really coming along, Tom. You even have a contingency for when the porters try to wring our necks. That's wonderful.
Sharing an impulse, both men reached out to grip the bottle standing between them. Neither released it.
Senlin met Adam's eye amid the unexpected stalemate. Obviously, the young man was working up to saying something more, to speaking his mind, and the bottle remained stranded between them while he did.
All right, out with it. What's on your mind, Adam?
Is this really the thing to do? Steal a ship?
I mean, you're arguing against it yourself. It seemed a fine idea when we were both stirred up by the whoremonger, but now, in the clear light of day...
He pulled at his collar until the second button popped open. Senlin sensed that the young man had been thinking about this for longer than he'd been sitting in the room. Perhaps it had been on his mind since their visit to the steam-pipe. His phrases were a little too exact, a little too practiced to be spontaneous.
"We'll make 100 enemies. Rodion, Finn Gol, the port workers, the crew, and captain we displace. Once we begin running, I don't think that we'll ever be able to stop. How will we live without steady work, or homes, or a patron? Who will we trust? Will we have to steal our fuel? Will we have to scavenge for food? What sort of life is that?"
"What sort of life is this?" Senlin said. "You told me you were worth a small fortune to the Commissioner. You robbed him. Why not ask for a ransom? Negotiate a deal. Give him what he wants, and he will pay you for it. I'm sure of it. Instead of running, we could buy our freedom."
"Adam," Senlin said, abruptly releasing the bottle and rocking back in his chair.
He crossed his arms.
"Powerful men don't bargain with men like us. They don't respect us or fear us, so there's nothing to keep them from backing out on a deal. There's no honour.
Remember your pirates, the ones who are responsible for the loss of your eye. How did that happen? You had a deal, didn't you? But you hadn't any power, and they knew it."
Senlin's mouth was dry, and spit was beginning to foam against his teeth.
"Even if, and I do mean if, the Commissioner was willing to haggle over a ransom, he would only be interested in paying for 2 things. First, his precious painting, which I do not have, and second, my head. My sincerest hope is that he has forgotten all about me. That is the best-case scenario."
In response to all of Senlin's passionate reasoning, Adam only shrugged.
"I'm not saying it isn't without risk, a calculated risk, but you're presuming an awful lot about how the Commissioner will react to a proposition that saves him effort and time. I don't see how that is any more ridiculous than engineering an elaborate plot and stealing a ship."
Adam radiated obstinate, youthful confidence, which struck an old nerve in Senlin, a headmaster's nerve. Adam concluded his argument smugly.
"I'm only trying to be reasonable."
"And I am trying to save your sister," Senlin shouted, more violently than he'd intended.
Though thrown off balance by the outburst, Adam stubbornly pressed the point. Even if you don't have the painting, you could sell him information about who does. With just a little money in our pocket, Sendlin cut him off.
No, Adam. No, I am not going to bargain with the commissioner. That's the end of it.
Sendlin pounded the table once, making his book jump. Adam looked as if he'd been slapped, which Sendlin regretted, though it did not cool his response.
Look. You will never have enough money to pry Valita loose of her contract, because Rodion sees no advantage in letting her go. He will just take your money and sell her again to someone else. Why not? What will you do to stop him? If you want to see your sister freed, we will have to do it ourselves.
Adam scowled, but said nothing. A long burst of hoots from the porters outside gave the gulf between them time to grow. Sendlin wiped his mouth and felt an unfamiliar tremor in his fingers. It wasn't the thought of Valita that had driven him to the brink of manic rage. It was Maria. It was always Maria. A week earlier, he'd finally given up his obsessive turning of her portrait and had stowed it out of sight under the loose floorboard, along with his journal and Ogier's key-mould pistol. He'd done it because she was becoming an abstraction, an image, an ideal. He felt it happening. The woman was disappearing. The memory of her thrilling voice, the taper of her agile fingers, and the subtle flirtations she used to console him in a crowded room. All of it was fading away, and in its place, growing larger and more real every day, was Ogier's painted icon. So, he had hidden her from himself in the hope that when he did glimpse her picture again, it would give him a little shock of memory, a little jolt of hope, and keep him a while longer from accepting the plodding, desolate life that stood in evidence all about him. Without another word, Adam stood and walked from the room. Sendlin did not try to stop him. He realized that he had made a mistake by confiding his fears and the flaws in his plan to the youthful Boreas. Adam was looking for direction, for a leader, for a captain, and having meant to or not, Sendlin had taken on the role. And now he had to act accordingly. The crew doesn't want to hear that the captain has doubts, or that the captain's plan is full of holes. It ruins their confidence, and then they begin to grasp at straws, just as Adam had done. It wasn't Adam's fault that Sendlin had made no progress in finding a crew, or a ship, or a wind. Pretty soon, if that lack of progress continued, Adam would just find some other piper to follow. Sendlin woke in the middle of the night to a wooden bang. The sound was like a door being slammed, but lower to the ground. Blearily, he wondered if it was a trap door. But his room didn't have a trap door. Perhaps it was an echo from the station yard, or a forgotten nightmare that had fooled his waking ear. In a daze, he opened his eyes, anticipating the dim golden gloom of the shuttered lamps outside. A red, glowing figure loomed at his bedside, twisting and struggling like a man amid a seizure. The revelation was immediate. It was the Red Hand. Impossibly, incredibly, the commissioner's executioner had found him. The assassin was pulling at his own knee. He had stepped on the faulty floorboard, and for the moment his foot was caught in Senlin's secret cubby. Adrenaline flooded Senlin's extremities with sudden sensation. Every nerve felt like a sparking fuse. Sendlin rolled out the far side of his bed, intent on making a break for the door. Instead, he tumbled to the floor, tangled in his sheets. He flailed like a fish caught in a net. Boards splintered behind him, and he turned in time to see the Red Hand lunging over the bed like some cosmic phenomenon, like a fireball blazing through the atmosphere. Then the meteor crashed down. The Red Hand bowled into Sendlin, and they became a knot of bedsheets and limbs. They crashed into the flimsy bureau, popping all three of the drawers out. Shirt sleeves roped about them. The assassin's brass cuff clipped Sendlin in the jaw, making his eyes pool with tears. Sendlin could see nothing but a red glow shrouded by white linen. It was like watching a forest fire through dense smoke. A sudden pressure on Senlin's arm kept him from swiping away the clean laundry.
"Where is the painting?"
the Red Hand said. His enunciation so flat and calm, he might have been asking Sendlin for the time of day.
"I don't know,"
Sendlin said, through gritted teeth. The tracery of veins made the man appear as a frozen firework, a spew of volcanic light. With his free arm, Senlin pulled a shirt over the vivid skull and looped the sleeve about the assassin's neck. The red hand seemed to gasp, and Senlin felt a little flight of hope. Perhaps he could fight his way free. But it was not a gasp of surprise. It was a sigh. A weary, contemptuous sigh. Senlin was boring his assassin. Before Senlin could tighten the makeshift noose, excruciating pain lanced up his shoulder. The red hand wrenched his arm with overwhelming, almost mechanical strength. He rolled with the pressure to keep his arm in its socket. Forced onto his stomach, he was left entirely helpless. He kicked like a child throwing a tantrum, but his heels hit nothing. The red hand yanked him up by the hair, and his spine bowed against the knee that dug into his tailbone. He felt like a stick of kindling preparing to snap. Then the floor flew at him. He had just enough time to look away before the side of his head bounced against it. Splinters bit his ear and cheek. For an instant, he was deaf. Then a ringing note, higher than hearing, slowly descended the scale like a falling bomb. His head was lifted and bounced a second time, and the wood now splashed beneath him. Motes appeared in his vision, yellow spiders crawling upon a red web. The red web opened its mouth, showing a little glowing furnace, a flame-like tongue. Senlin could feel the man's warm breath when the red hand said,
"You intellectuals are always so surprised to discover how fragile your body is. The mind is so robust, so remote, but muscles and bones are as simple as tied-up straw. They unravel and snap, and the more they break, the more the mind shrinks. In the moments before the cascade into death, the great intellect is reduced to a silent kernel. The mind is nothing more than a door into the dark."
Senlin wanted to scream, but couldn't.
"That is where you're going, Thomas. The voracious, indifferent, eternal dark. Where is the painting?"
Made desperate by fear and dumb by the beating, Senlin cast about for something, anything, to defend himself with. His hand slapped along the floor, searching. The wood tingled under his hand. He was disoriented. Which way was the door? If he could only get a hold of his aero rod, he would at least be able to die while defending himself. But there was nothing, just laundry and splinters. He realized he couldn't swallow before he understood that he couldn't breathe. The assassin now sat on his back, pulling his neck like a rider trying to stop a horse. A sudden, unexpected rush of euphoria filled Senlin. Dimly, he recognized the gladness for what it was, the coming of death. And he was oddly relieved. The red hand was wrong. There was light in that expanse. There was peace to think. He let his mind wander. He wondered about Ogier. He must have hid the painting well, because it hadn't been found. Maybe Ogier had died before he confessed the hiding place of his beloved girl with a paper boat. Senlin saw the girl now, standing in the full brilliance of the bath's kaleidoscopic light, standing over her shadow, dark as a hole in the world. And in his vision of the painting, Maria was standing with her, skirts bunched up in one hand, her other hand holding the girl's. He watched from the shore. Neither faced him, neither needed to. They were happy. The world was bright. Amid this fondness and calm, a fly began to buzz, a single dark speck of thought. The fly refused to be caught and refused to go away. He battered at it. Whatever small revelation was trying to disturb his paradise, it wouldn't have much longer to live. How long did house flies live? He would ignore it. It bumped against his face. He swatted again, and the fly seemed to slow, to let itself be caught. He felt it fizz in his closed hand. He pulled his fist up to his face and uncurled his fingers. In the middle of his palm lay a key. Then the world began to shake, and the subtle tremor quickly becoming a grinding, stampeding earthquake. The water leapt and boiled and splashed up the legs of Maria and the girl whose hand she held. Fine mortar began salting his upturned face in the utter darkness. He realized he wasn't ready. He wasn't ready. Then the ground leapt out from under him, and he began to fall. He landed in his body again, on the floor of his room. He was lying on his back. The red, glowing figure shook him roughly, and it didn't seem like the first time he had done that. Senlin felt warmth pooling in his mouth. He swallowed and coughed until he could breathe. The sensation was painful, but full of relief.
"I'm sorry it has taken me so long to find you. I don't like to be tardy. I visited Ogier months ago. I was right on time for that conversation. It didn't go well for him. Either your compatriot was fatally stubborn, or the truth was unfortunate. I asked him the same question I ask you now for the last time. Where is the painting you stole?"
Senlin felt a pang of sorrow for the painter, but he was equally amazed that Ogier had been willing to die to keep his painting from the commissioner. It all suddenly seemed so out of proportion, and the fact that the commissioner had continued hunting for Senlin in the ensuing months, had somehow found him and had then loosed his dog on him, all for a painting. Obviously, he wouldn't be able to convince the assassin of the absurdity of his mission. If Senlin wanted to survive, he had to tell him something. Then he recalled the key that had appeared in his hand in his deathly vision, and an idea, slim and unlikely, sprang to mind. His voice came out as a croak.
"It's in a locked drawer," he said. "I need to get the key."
Chapter 10. The Banyan O'Morrow is a flat-bottomed scow that's as ugly as a pig's nose. One 30-pound gun, heavily corroded, is its only defense. The motley crew of six would probably surrender without argument, a charmless but feasible candidate. On second inspection, rot has turned the bulwarks soft as cake. It is a death trap. Every Man's Tower, One Man's Travails, by T. Senlin. Senlin braced himself over the shattered gap in the floorboard. As he reached into the darkened cubby, a boot heel settled on the back of his neck, threatening as a thumbnail to a flea.
"If you come up with anything but a key, I will step on you," the Red Hand said.
Senlin hesitated. Sweat or blood trickled around the rind of his skull and down his jaw. The jailer's key lay under the painting of Maria. He had no choice but to pull her out first to get to the key.
"There's a painting here," Senlin said, "but it's not the one you're looking for. The key is under it."
"Let me see it."
As soon as the painting emerged, a glowing hand flashed down and snatched it from him. Senlin could not watch the assassin's scrutiny of the painting, but he saw the result. Hurled against the wall before him, the frame exploded about the painting. Senlin winced. He couldn't tell if his painting was ruined, but there was nothing he could do about it now. He reached again into the hollow with deliberate slowness. The pressure softened on his neck when he came up with the key. The Red Hand removed his heel. Senlin stood, and his legs were as rickety as one of his chairs.
"What does the key open?"
the Red Hand asked, in his distracted, almost dreamy way. Senlin cleared his muddy throat. He teetered on his feet and said, without inflection,
"You."
He pulled the small trigger inside the key's bow. The report was no louder than the crack of a wooden spoon. The pea-wide barrel gave a snort of smoke. It was, Senlin had to admit, a more pitiful result than he had hoped for. Unruffled, the Red Hand glanced down at the stain forming on his shirt front. The slow ooze of blood was garnet bright.
"You know what's funny," the Red Hand said humorlessly. "You look at me and see a man, a head shorter and a hand wider than yourself, but a man nevertheless."
The assassin reached forward and gathered the folds of Senlin's nightshirt into his deceptively small fists. He pulled Senlin closer to his bland, jack-o'-lantern face.
"So you assume that I am like you, that I share your cognition, your burden of conscience, your intestinal parasites?"
but I am nothing like you.
His breath smelled strongly of formaldehyde, and up close, Senlin saw that his skin had the rubbery appearance of a preserved frog. Senlin was raised to his toes and then lifted from